Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What happens if it kind of tumbles over into something that's not acute? It kind of hangs around and, you know, falls below the radar. You don't get those classic signs of inflammation. You don't have the redness and swelling and heat. You haven't got a fever 24/7.
Yeah.
But there's something smoldering below the surface. And that this is what we call chronic inflammation.
Welcome to the Doctor's Kitchen podcast with me, Dr. Rupi, where we're going to be discussing the most important topics and concepts in the medicinal qualities of food and lifestyle. We're going to be blending together the science with delicious recipes inspired by cuisines from across the world, as well as the topics that you're most fascinated by, and me as well. Today, we've got Dr. Jenna Machocki back on the podcast to talk about eating for inflammation. Now, you might wonder why I've got an immunologist coming in to talk about inflammation. That will become very clear once we get into the conversation. She holds a PhD from the Faculty of Inflammation, Repair and Development at Imperial College. She's a lecturer in immunology at the University of Sussex, who uses rigorous scientific research with concepts both old and new, holistic and conventional, to cultivate long-term health and well-being. She's brilliant. If you haven't listened to the first podcast that she was on, Eating for Immunity, I highly, highly recommend you do. We go into a little bit about her background, where she's from, and how she's come to this understanding of food, lifestyle, blended with the science, and why it's so important for the health and well-being of our population. As well as being editor at the Scientific Journal Annals of Advanced Biomedical Sciences, she's a mother of twins and trained as a fitness instructor. In today's podcast, we talk about inflammation as a concept, why it's becoming so popular in the medical literature, and why it's so relevant to a host of different medical specialties. Also, don't forget my new book, Eat to Beat Illness, is going to be out on the 21st of March. You can pre-order on Amazon and all good bookstores as well. Listen right to the end, where I summarize our talk and give you some actionable tips, as well as the show notes and where you can find Dr. Jenna. Let's crack on with the podcast. Jenna.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. I mean, the response from our last podcast, and if listeners haven't listened to the last podcast, definitely listen to it. It's in two parts on eating for immunity. Honestly, I had one of the biggest responses. The number of people it's helped, the number of people it's clarified information for,
super,
the way they see immunity and how mm-hmm. it works, it literally works. They were very, very thankful for it. So,
super. Yeah, it was really nice to get so much good feedback. And even some students saying, I've been studying this as part of my degree, and it was
really
quite helpful to untangle, you know, some of the things. So, yeah, super.
That's cool. If it's helpful, helping like university students, then, yeah, we're doing a good thing.
It's a complicated field, so yeah, it's probably a good kind of overview. So yeah, if anyone's not listened to that one, it might be a good idea to give a bit of context for today.
Definitely, yeah, because we go into a bit of your background, how you grew up, what you were eating, you know, your family ties and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, so today we're going to go into inflammation as a concept. Mm-hmm. and why it's becoming so popular in the medical literature. Yeah. It's almost become like this unifying theory that ties lots of different lifestyle-related illnesses, yes, like hypertension, diabetes, obesity. But I think a lot of people are going to be confused as to why I've got an immunologist talking, yeah, about inflammation. So why don't we clarify what we mean and why you're here in the, yeah, hot seat again?
Back in the hot seat. Yeah, yeah, so immunology is the study of every bit of the immune system, and inflammation is a component of the immune system. So I guess that's why it has a good fit with me. But the nice thing about the immune system is it kind of infiltrates into every aspect of our health and disease. But inflammation itself is, it's not a single phenomenon. It's a real kind of complex response that actually keeps us well and protects us from infection. So it's essential. It's really essential that we can mount an inflammatory response and defend ourselves. You know, I mentioned last time we live in this real microbial world. Mm. All the time, these germs are trying to infect us. We're trying to evade them. There's this dynamic relationship that's always going on, and inflammation is one of our weapons against them.
Yeah. You know, the analogy I like to use just from the get-go is that what we used to think about microbes about 30 yeah. years ago is all being bad for us.
Definitely.
It's almost like how we view inflammation today. Like, yes, any sort of inflammation is bad for us. But yeah. as you just explained, you know, there are huge benefits to having inflammation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
why it's a very important process when it yeah. comes to cell signaling, when it comes to host defense yeah. and a whole bunch of other
yeah,
facets of
exactly.
our-
it's really important. And we don't want to totally extinguish it. And obviously with it being a bit of a buzzword at the moment, it would sound like we have, you know, there's anti-inflammatory diets, anti-inflammatory lifestyles, we want to get rid of inflammation, but we yeah. don't actually. The point to make, I think, is that it's acute by design. So a lot of things in biology are, you know, the form follows the function. So it's a short-term assault. Mm. It's only ever meant to be short-term.
Short-term adaptive response.
Yes, yeah, exactly. To get to, like, a means to an end, really. And it's supposed to cause damage because it's trying to remove something that might cause even greater damage to us. So it's trying to get rid of an infection. If anyone's ever been sick, or, you know, if you cut your finger and you get, you know, some bacteria in there, you're going to have a lot of damage to your own tissue. And that's mostly your immune system mounting a response, an inflammatory response, to get rid of those pathogens, those germs that have got into your tissue. So that, you know, leads me to, I think, one of the most important points is that there is some collateral damage that comes with mounting an inflammatory response. It's trying to get rid of something that's going to cause you damage, and as a collateral, you incur a little bit of damage yourself because it's a toxic process. Mm. I think it's also important to mention that it's a complete cycle. So people think about inflammation being switched on, but it actually has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And that end is actually quite important. That's the resolution. That it's an active process that brings it all to a close. And it's involved in healing and repair and getting us back to, like, a normal state.
That's a really good point, because I think a lot of people think of inflammation in binary terms. Like,
yes.
You either have inflammation or you do not have inflammation.
Yes. Yeah.
And actually, it's kind of like a story. Like,
yeah, exactly. It's a cyclic process. Yeah. And each one of those parts to the inflammatory process triggers the next part. And so it's a kind of very delicately orchestrated process that one will lead to the next, will lead to the next. Mm.
The design of it, and when you're following, I remember doing this at medical school and absolutely hating immunology. Like, I found it so just wasn't intuitive to me.
Yeah.
It wasn't until, like, I actually had some clinical experience on the wards,
yeah.
witnessing what inflammation does and how it's related yeah. to a whole bunch of different things, and then going back to the science, like, I get it now.
Yeah.
Like, this is what's happening at this particular point in
yes.
this patient's journey.
Yeah, it's yeah. really interesting, isn't it? Because I've struggled with when I'm teaching immunology to the at the very beginning, to bring it to life, because they really just have to learn all these complicated pathways. In fact, this last week I was teaching them the complement system.
Oh my god, yeah.
And they were just, I was like, you're all gonna hate me, it's just the beginning of term, it gets better, honestly. But you know, when it comes to life, it's that's when the beauty and the sort of art of immunology, I think, comes alive.
I can imagine you being a very popular lecturer, because you do bring it to life. I can imagine you're like, okay, this is complement, but and this is why it's related to a particular condition, or yeah.
Well, one of the things I actually, just totally going on a tangent,
yeah.
The complement system is this really complicated cascade in the immune system. It's part of the inflammatory response, really, but it also weeds out the the connections in our brain that we don't need anymore. So when we're growing as a child and we're making all these different neuronal connections, the complement system is part of the way that we remove the ones we don't need and strengthen the ones we do need. So
oh, wow.
It's really cool. And it's been implicated in Alzheimer's disease.
Haven't come across that. You must send me that.
Check it out and send you the details. So like it becomes this dull pathway that I'm teaching students, but then you're like, it's so relevant, you know, and this is why you need to know this. So I think half the time they're just humouring me because I'm jumping about the lecture theatre. In fact, the one yesterday when I was teaching, they'd been sitting in the same lecture theatre for 3 hours and I had them at the last hour.
The graveyard
shift. And immediately got them to all start running around the room and squatting and jumping.
Really?
And, because I was like, you have to move. You've been sitting in this room and it's hot and you're all going to be half asleep. And crazy.
But. Oh, that's great. No, that's really good. I mean, like, we know that there's mitochondrial biogenesis when you start moving, you start doing like some HIIT training and stuff.
Exactly.
So that will feed their brains, literally.
Yeah. Like. So, yeah, they think I'm mad. Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Inflammation is our warfare. It's part of what the immune system's using to get rid of things that might hurt us. It causes us a little bit of damage on the sideline, but it's okay because it's short term. It's only ever meant to be acute. Part of the reason it damages us is because it uses a lot of oxidative stress to cause damage to the thing that's infecting you or trying to cause you damage. And I think that's where we think about antioxidants and sort of put them on a pedestal because they're extinguishing this oxidative damage by the inflammatory response. But that's probably something we can go on to later when we talk about nutrition. I think it's very simplistic to talk about inflammation as a single thing. There's like lots of different components.
Yeah.
It's really complex and its relationship to our health is also quite complex. So we need it. It's protecting us.
I think a lot of people struggle with the concept of oxidative stress as well, like, oxidative species being produced and causing this collateral damage, essentially.
Yeah.
It's not as, I mean, we're probably going to go into this with the nutrition, but it's not as simple as you eat antioxidants and therefore, you get rid of the oxidative stress. There's a whole bunch of other chemicals involved in this process.
Exactly, and the field's kind of evolving.
Mm.
So it's the short term, I think, is really important to clarify, and also the sort of cardinal features. I'm sure you got taught this in medical school.
Yeah.
The cardinal features of inflammation: the heat, the redness, the swelling, the pain, losing function. So we all can recognize if we've been sick and we get a fever, or you like the example when you cut your finger and it's swelling and red. And these are the features we see.
I'm probably testing myself now, but there's the Latin terminology, right?
Calor,
dolor,
rubor.
That's it.
What's the next one?
In the show notes.
Yeah. So I often use the analogy of the immune system as like an army. It's standing by, it's ready to mount this assault, this inflammatory assault when something is going wrong. But whenever you have an army, there's inbuilt peacekeepers inside the army. And this is the bit that I'm personally a bit more fascinated by, because most of the time we don't have some kind of inflammatory response. Most of the time, the peacekeepers are working hard to keep inflammation switched off. And you mentioned earlier that it's not a binary thing. And I think this is really true of everything to do with the immune system. It's like an analog, a rheostat that you're adjusting, which is quite useful in a way when we start to talk about lifestyle medicine, because although we might not be able to switch off with a diet, we can maybe just tweak it, adjust it, and there are ways that it could act as an adjunct to more pharmaceutical level therapies.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it comes to a hilt whenever I'm talking to patients about an anti-inflammatory diet, for example, because it gives the impression that this anti-inflammatory diet is going to switch off something very rapidly, whereas like you said, it's like an analog. It's like gently easing something as an adjunct to all the other therapies that we have.
Yeah.
And I'm personally fascinated by what keeps us in that environmental balance of dynamic changes are going on, what are the peacekeepers doing when nothing is actually, like right now I'm not suffering any inflammation. What is keeping me in that state?
Yes, exactly. I think we often in biology use the term homeostasis, so like keeping the stasis, everything staying the same. And I actually think it's a bit misleading because we're never really in stasis. We're always kind of tipping one way or another.
That's a really good point.
You know, it's just about trying to find that kind of biting point. And, you know, it's normal to sort of, you know, sway from one to the other with whatever is going on in your life.
That's a really good point, because I love the concept of homeostasis, and I see this almost in everything in what we do, like the changing of the seasons or when we're you know, just walking flat or just not having any thoughts, or we're euthymic, where we're not happy, we're not sad, we're just in that kind of intermediate. And keeping that sort of balance, that equilibrium, I think is fascinating. And now you said that, like it's more of a dynamic state rather than static state.
It's impossible to be static. It's you know, but we can sort of go within a buffer that's keeping us healthy, but sometimes it might slide off too far one way or the other. So
there's a huge psychological element to all this, I think, and there's a bit of philosophy involved as well.
I've been thinking a lot about the mind body connection recently, because especially talking about inflammation, it's a reaction to something that's going on in our environment. And how do we know what's going on in environment? Like, our cells can sense things at a molecular level, but they also are receiving information from what we're seeing and hearing and sensing with our other senses, and that's relaying information to the immune system as well of what it should do. So it's gathering all this full picture and then deciding how it should respond, and it only makes sense that it would marry like that. But we don't really tend to talk about them as the sort of whole organism of mind and body working together.
Yeah, I think from a conventional medicine point of view, we look at that, we have a myopic focus, I think, on the internal stresses at the molecular level and trying to dampen them down with therapeutics.
Yeah.
But like you said, we essentially have multitudes of different stimuli, whether it be psychological stimuli, whether it be molecular stimuli, whether it be gut, and which is why you have this gut brain axis, and it's so many different things that could be resulting in an inflammatory picture.
I mean, all of our immune cells have receptors for different neuropeptides and neurotransmitters, so they're responding to what's happening in our brain, and that's responding to what we're seeing around us, and so it kind of only makes sense. But it's only now, I think, that people are starting to integrate that idea.
Yeah, that whole idea of a neuropeptide, so just for the listeners, that's essentially a receptor for a production of amino acids produced by
the brain.
By the brain.
Like it could be something like adrenaline or there's different stress hormones.
So the very fact that these cells have receptors on them essentially tells us that there's an evolutionary purpose as to why we are receptive to things produced by the brain.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes sense. That's the kind of, we've kind of talked about inflammation and the acute sense. And I kind of feel like that's not the end of the story.
No,
that's not why we're here talking about inflammation. That's not why it's everywhere in the media and anti-inflammatory diets and everything. Because, as I said, by design, it's supposed to be acute. But what happens if it kind of tumbles over into something that's not acute? It kind of hangs around and, you know, falls below the radar. You don't get those classic signs of inflammation. You don't have the redness and swelling and heat. You haven't got a fever 24/7.
Yeah.
But there's something smoldering below the surface. And that this is what we call chronic inflammation.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit more of what we're probably going to expand on today.
When it comes to lifestyle-related disease, it's not something that you can see in the form of a swollen joint or, you know, something that's quite obvious to look at. It's just the sort of like indolent
more
symptoms.
More subtle. And I think that, you know, there's got to be a stimulus for inflammation. There's got to be a trigger. And in the early days of immunology, people thought that was seeing an infection, because the molecules on top of germs and viruses, bacteria, look very different to what we look like. So our body could say, oh, that's a germ, I'm going to mount an inflammatory response. But now we realise that the immune system, again, it's not that binary. It doesn't just recognise germs, but it recognises danger inside our bodies. We use that term danger to really encompass anything that's moving us off track. So chronic inflammation can be triggered by stress. So that's a danger system. We've just talked about, you know, different activity in the brain and what that's transmitting through the body. It can even be triggered by exercise. So exercise is very stressful, can be very stressful on the body.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realise that, that we have like a dynamic relationship with the stresses from exercise.
Yeah, there
is a dose response where too much is detrimental, too little is detrimental. It's a sweet spot.
Exactly, finding the sweet spot. Smoking's a classic one. Gut permeability, so leaky gut. Again, it's one of those kind of terms that sounds a bit woo-woo, I spent, you know, 8 years in Switzerland working on leaky gut. It's definitely not woo-woo, but it just needs to be portrayed the right way.
And eating tons of chocolate as well.
Yeah. And cheese. And I think one thing that's probably quite topical today is obesity. I don't really like the word obesity. It's a bit of a problematic word, but... how the concept of how what we're eating can trigger inflammation.
So it could
be these kind of danger signals to our body.
It's quite a tough one, that one, isn't it? Because obesity as a term has fallen out of favour. There's got to be a more sort of objective way of describing what we mean by obesity. I suppose, like, you know, to use a medical term, adipose excess, or the particular adipose tissue that you find around your visceral organs, which is the most metabolically active and therefore inflammation producing. Which isn't necessarily picked up by your BMI measurements or even by looking at a person.
So these things are a little bit more insidious. You know, they're not like when you get hit with a really bad infection and you get this huge inflammation and it goes away within a week. These are slow, smouldering away, kind of insidious triggers that sort of creep. And one thing that I've been personally interested in and professionally now in a lot of the research I'm doing is what is the cumulative effect of having low-grade chronic inflammation?
Yeah.
No one's ever really done those studies. So that's something I'm kind of trying to pursue. Like, normally we have a lot of checks and balances in to switch off inflammation when triggers go away. And that cyclic process I mentioned earlier where there's like a complete resolution. But these get worn out. It's like anything. You know, if you never get your car serviced, you know, you're going to wear them out.
I like that analogy as well. Yeah. There's a lot of analogies going on today, but I do like that analogy.
Helps.
I think it's quite...
This morning, actually, I sent my bike off to get... like a bit of an MOT because I'd worn out the bike, the brake pads from like going down the hills in Brighton. And it was like not braking anymore. But you know, like these feedback loops, they get worn out. They get desensitized. So when inflammation spills over into something chronic and it's going on long term, but it's much more subtle. It's a much more lower level, like almost below detection.
Yeah. And that's why when I try and explain it, and actually this is something that I talk about in the chapter on inflammation in the book Eat to Beat Illness, they can be very vague and they're very hard to actually ascertain. And because of how vague they are, you know, it's not something that someone could measure. Not necessarily something you can pick out on a clinical history, even though that's exceptionally important. It's just something that you just need to be a little bit aware of. Is it, you know, that excess fatigue, or is it like a cognitive dysfunction, or is it, you know, the inability to lose some weight, or, you know, and there's so many triggers for it. Like you were saying, you know, smoking and diet. And
it's probably like multiple triggers involved. It's probably very rare that it's just because you're a smoker or just because you have a poor diet. It's probably the whole composite of lifestyle.
And this is why I think inflammation is almost like the poster boy for lifestyle medicine, because, or poster girl, because it, you know, it is very holistic in terms of the way we have to think about it and the way we have to treat it. And by essentially plugging all these different holes, improving your sleep, you know, making sure that you're getting exposure to nature, you know, your psychological stimuli, being part of a functioning, cohesive community, and you know, sense of purpose and all these different things. That's how we actually ameliorate inflammation imbalance.
Exactly. Like thinking of this rheostat that, you know, you might not be able to change certain stresses in your life or things that you're doing that are maybe causing this low level inflammation, but you can maybe tweak it a little bit to take the edge off with certain diet and lifestyle changes. So yeah, this chronic inflammation has really kind of shot up in the last few years in literature as a proxy to disease, non-communicable diseases, so non-infectious diseases that we didn't previously think about in the context of inflammation. So things like atherosclerosis, you know, cholesterol was really in the limelight for a long time. No one was really saying that inflammation is upstream of atherosclerosis. And now they are. It's like, oh, wait a minute.
It's not a simple plumbing problem. There's a lot more to it.
And I think the questions we don't know is how long has the inflammation been going on before it causes you a problem? And what's the cumulative effect of, you know, is it several years, several decades? I think when you think of the immune system and the inflammatory arm, what we see is as we age, that becomes much easier to trigger. So it's, I guess from an evolutionary perspective, we kind of want to get past the time when we pass on our genes, and then evolution doesn't really care what happens.
That's a very good point. We're not designed to go until like 100, like past 100, really, because there isn't an evolutionary purpose for having a 100-year-old as we're not fertile.
I mean, evolution doesn't actually care about anything else but passing on the genes, you could argue. And I think this term inflammaging, have you heard that? Been coined in the last few years. And it was a pathologist who coined it because they found that whenever they were looking at biopsies from like a liver biopsy from a child versus a liver biopsy from an 80-year-old, they would already be able to tell by looking at the sample under the microscope which one was from the elderly person, which one was from the child, even if they were blinded to it, because there's a subtle low level of inflammation, this infiltration of these immune cells that are inflammatory that you can see in the tissue of an older person. So it just creeps up as we get older.
And there's a whole bunch of reasons for that, right? Because we were just talking before the show about how my last modules for my nutritional medicine master's, it was talking about immunosenescence. So that's the whole concept of your immune system becoming less functioning as we age. And how that, as a peacekeeper role, is less likely to do its job. And then inflammation essentially creeps up. And also, if you combine that with the knowledge that our microbiota serves less of a function, and it becomes less diverse as we age as well, for a multitude of different reasons. There's that, and there's also, if you combine that with sarcopenia, which is essentially, you know, you're losing your protein, your muscle stores, and it's being replaced with fat. You know, and that's going to be inflammation. So there's a whole host of reasons why we see inflammaging.
I think one thing, maybe we even mentioned it last time when you said about sarcopenia, so this muscle wasting, the muscles, when you work them, the skeletal muscles produce these particular cytokines that stop the thymus from shrinking. And the thymus is producing the T cells, which are like the master controllers of the immune system, and the T regulatory cells, the peacekeepers as well. So getting your exercise in, even when you're, you know, well into your old age, is really important to preserve that part of the immune system, and it keeps the inflammation in check. So, you know, I think it's natural as you age, things go wrong, you know, like with my bike analogy. It's like 12 years old and, you know, I ride
12
it to
years.
Death.
And in Brighton as well, there's a lot of salt in the air there.
And it sits outside because I don't have anywhere in to keep it covered, you know, so. And I haven't had it serviced in quite a long time. So there's like a wear and tear, and it's the same with our
bodies. And plus you're going downhill on it all the time as well. So.
Normally rushing for work. When we think of like this inflammaging, and you start to think about, well, what do people die of in old age, you know, when it's like heart disease and cancer, or falling from, you know, muscle wasting and metabolic dysfunction. These are all things that happen to us naturally as we age, but if we have heightened levels of this sort of low grade chronic inflammation, it seems to just bring them much earlier in life. So, you know, as we age, we would all get these things anyway, probably, but it seems to happen much sooner.
this chronic low level of inflammation has been termed, or there's a term, meta-inflammation in the literature.
Yeah.
I quite like that because it kind of sort of like, it's not inflammation for one thing, it's just like inflammation from multiple sources, yes, like we just described.
Yeah, yeah. And they tend to kind of make the link to when there's a problem with the metabolism, yeah, as well. Mm. So not in an infectious component, because classically, we're all trained to think of inflammation to protect us from infection.
Exactly.
But then
yeah,
they call it like sterile inflammation. There's no infection present,
yeah,
but it's being triggered by something that's going on below the surface.
Yeah. There's an argument about Alzheimer's having an inflammatory component.
Yes.
And one of those is from indolent viruses or bacteria that are causing low level of inflammation. So things like EBV, some viruses from the herpes family.
Yeah, exactly, because they sit dormant in our nerves and can live there for a really long time.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm watching that research, like just seeing what's coming out of it.
It's so exciting.
It's very exciting to watch because it's almost like someone has to pin all these different things together.
Yes.
Because you can't just go down one route. You can't just think, okay, well, there's indolent viruses or microbes that are causing inflammation. Thus, if we just give them, you know, antivirals or antibiotics, we're going to cure the Alzheimer's, or we're going to reverse it or prevent it. There's so many other things going on.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's an important message for generally what people who are listening, that people are always seeking for a magic bullet.
Mm.
And I think it's going to take a multi-pronged approach when you have these more complex scenarios with things that are, you know, like smoldering away low-grade inflammation and that being upstream to a whole host of kind of age-related disorders. I think, you know, it's not ever going to be one thing because these are very complex biological processes under the surface. So we have to kind of come from different angles.
There's a whole bunch of things that I can think of being a general practitioner.
Mm.
And, you know, people coming through the door and they have these sort of vague symptoms. And there's so many different diagnoses you can pin on someone with these sorts of diagnoses, whether it's low-grade depression, whether there's an underlying infection, whether it's something gut-related. You know, there's so many different presentations of low-grade inflammation. It's very hard to actually pin down. And we're taught in a conventional, so we're going on a tangent now, we're taught in a conventional model of healthcare to come up with a diagnosis, the diagnosis, and treat on the basis of said diagnosis with usually one agent, if not two, or something like that. So, that whole model has to change.
Yeah, it has to change because our healthcare problems have changed. I think that grew from, you know, pre-antibiotic era when, you know, people got serious infections and needed to be treated. And you didn't see so many of these conditions that we're talking about, the sort of more metabolic deregulation and things associated with obesity and type 2 diabetes. Like, they were not such big problems. So the healthcare system has to change, but it's a big ship to turn.
It is huge. And I kind of despair when there's a lot of people out there who are becoming very distrusting of doctors for that reason, because we go and then we've been taught to essentially treat one thing. Whereas actually, you know, there's going to have to be a whole paradigm shift amongst medical practitioners, which I think a lot of people, particularly the younger generations, are very willing to entertain. But also we actually have to teach patients to become the experts of their own health and take a lot more responsibility than has previously been put on them before, where, you know, people from older generations, I believe, were taught, if you got the sniffles, go see the doctor.
Yeah.
If you have anything that might be a symptom, go see the doctor.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of relationship that probably has to evolve.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of the work you're doing, like people on the same page as you, my mini Instagram following, trying to get the word out. I think we could mention the inflammasome because it's a cool word.
I really like the word inflammasome. Brilliant.
I think you posted about that graphical abstract on your Instagram, and I think that was one of my first Instagram posts.
Really?
With a little picture of
nice. I'm going to look back at that.
Yeah, like a year ago or something.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, so the inflammasome, apart from being a cool name, it's a thing that the immune system uses to sense what's going on in its environment. And it's particularly sensitive to things that change in our body to do with diet and you know, danger, things like having oxidized cholesterol, like stuff that we know is bad, and it switches on inflammation. It has turns on this transcription factor, NF-kappa-B is kind of like the daddy-o of, of all the downstream.
The daddy-o, I like that, yeah. NF-kappa-B comes up literally all the time. Whenever I'm reading like papers and myself, like, NF-kappa-B,
NF-kappa-B, right? It's basically the switch that turns on all these different inflammatory cascades. Mm. There you go, go off and run with it. So you kind of want to not only turn it on when it's necessary. And it can also send stress with our mitochondria, so the powerhouse of the cell that's providing the energy. And it can sense when we have an excess of calories. So this is why I find obesity quite a tricky term, because I think it's not just obesity, but just eating too much.
Yeah.
And eating some of the wrong things as well, and not having the antioxidants and everything that we do need to some degree in the diet.
Yeah, that's why you can get some people who have just as much of an inflammatory component, but not have the obesity for a number of different reasons.
Yes,
whether it be microbiome or whether it be genetic even.
Yeah.
But if you're eating an excess of the wrong type of calories that are nutrient poor, energy dense, you're going to have this inflammation component.
And you're not countering it with other things in the diet that are going to be really beneficial.
Yeah, the anti-inflammatories.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that the inflammasomes inform this particular cell death, which has got another cool name.
Yeah.
Pyrotosis.
Oh, pyrotosis, I know. Everyone's going to be switching off.
I know,
They're just going geeking out on some
pyro
science.
From the Latin, like meaning fire or something. Yeah. Or like, anyway, geeky names aside,
I think the other thing that'd be interesting to mention, you know, you mentioned that the symptoms of chronic inflammation are imperfect. We don't know really what would be the composite of somebody who has a low-grade inflammation, but without any overt disease, we don't know what those symptoms are. They could be really vague, insidious, not just feeling quite yourself, and headaches or malaise, but also going back to how the immune system talks to the mind. When inflammation is triggered, it's telling your body that there's a danger, there's something there, you should go and retreat and get well again. So it tells your brain to sort of withdraw from the world.
Yeah.
And we know this, we call it sickness behaviors. So things that the inflammatory response is producing, they're acting on the brain. The brain is then giving the signal, okay, I shouldn't go out, you know, all singing and dancing, because there's something going on and my body has to fight it. And I should retreat. And I think that's where now we're starting to see the link with depression and mental ill health.
Yes, yeah.
So this could be a kind of red flag. And we know that many people with mental ill health don't respond to pharmacological agents. And they're starting to do trials looking at how they might improve with anti-inflammatory interventions.
I was going to suggest the SMILES trial that was out in Australia, I believe. I think I referenced it in the new book where I talk about mood.
Yes.
Because I think even now it's quite taboo to talk about nutrition and mental health because of this, again, binary thought process where, you know, if you just take this diet, then you're going to switch off your inflammation, your mental health issues. In the same way, we, I think, have been led to believe wrongly, or maybe it's just a misinterpretation of antidepressants and how those are a magic cure, essentially, for mental health issues, whereas actually it's a very, very complex condition.
Yeah.
But it is really, really interesting to see things like the SMILES trial that essentially encourage a Mediterranean style of eating with lots of fresh legumes and lots of different antioxidant-rich, colourful vegetables, nuts and seeds, extra virgin olive oil and fatty acids, and how this is having a demonstrable, measurable impact on people's mood.
Yeah, it's amazing. Mm. It's so cool. Yeah, that was another study that got like lots of different kind of discussions going, I think, yeah, when it came out.
Definitely, yeah. And the Mind Diet as well, even though that's more towards the dementia side of things, is again a modified Mediterranean diet that encourages the consumption of things like anthocyanin-rich berries and stuff, purely from a cognitive point of view. But again, you know, there are some other sort of knock-on effects from that diet as well, in terms of happiness and subjective scores of like well-being.
Yeah, so I think that's a good kind of, transition into anti-inflammatory lifestyle. Really is it?
It seems like literally everyone's on this anti-inflammatory sort of like, or there's tons of like supplements with claims of anti-inflammation that give the impression that inflammation is something that everyone needs to rid themselves of, you know.
It's the same,
like I said, I think it's a similar viewpoint to how we used to see microbes in our environment as being bad and they all need to be, you know, removed. Whereas actually, like we've just been saying, inflammation is a very important cell signaling process.
And I think, you know, having an anti-inflammatory lifestyle in today's world is kind of an uphill battle. I certainly find, knowing what I know, that it's hard, because modern life, it's quite stressful at times. It's busy, and you know, we're bombarded with things telling us what we shouldn't do and shouldn't eat, and you know, it's not easy to you know, live the anti-inflammatory lifestyle as all of the, you know, information we're given would pertain that we should.
Exactly.
But I think if people are thinking about this in a pragmatic way, you want to really look at where is the inflammation coming from. We've mentioned like a few things, you know, being sedentary, smoking, certain dietary components. But I think stress is like a huge one.
Yeah.
And it's something that people don't really maybe recognize.
Absolutely,
much.
Yeah. We had Rongen on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about the concept that he's got in his book about micro stress doses.
Yeah.
Which I think is very interesting. Because I have those micro stress doses myself, you know, when the alarm clock goes off and I'm in a deep slumber, that's a little stress for me.
Yeah.
I no longer keep my phone anywhere near my bedroom, but I know a lot of people do because it's their alarm clock.
Yeah, it's their alarm clock.
But you know, I have an alarm clock now, so there is no excuse. But
I have my children.
Exactly, yeah. So there you go, your micro stress dose in the morning, even though you remember you love them and everything.
Yeah.
But there's so many different elements to your morning routine that will give you just little bits of stress.
Yeah.
And that's why I personally find a morning mantra, and this is going down the psychological route now, but a morning mantra really does settle me in the morning.
Yeah.
So I sit on the edge of my bed. I think I've shared this in the past, but I sit on the edge of my bed, and even if it's grey and raining outside, even if I don't feel well rested, even though I know I've got a ton of things I need to do today, I always say this one line to me, and it can be personalised. It can be anything, but the world is beautiful. I'm going to have a productive day. I am super happy and I'm well loved. And you know, just that as a reminder for me brings my stress level that my alarm clock has given me right back down.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I think it's well, for me, maybe with, you know, having a science mind, I like to think of it in terms of the biochemistry. If I think if what I'm doing, a bit of breathing, a bit of like, you know, positive attitude, focusing, just taking a moment of pause, that's having a biochemical effect in my body, and I know it, and I know,
absolutely,
you know, the pathways that are going to be triggered.
Actually, let's talk about that, because I don't think a lot of people realize that the process of deep breathing actually reduces, literally measurably reduces inflammation in your body.
Exactly, yeah. So I think that, and in fact, that's something I do with my kids when they get, you know, they're four. They get crazy and they get really like strung up about the most stupid things. Obviously it means the world to them, but
going to the doctors.
Now I get them to do this thing where I'm like, we take a really deep breath in and we're like, fill our lungs, and then we're like blowing it all out to the clouds, and they love it.
Nice.
And sometimes when I'm like in the morning trying to like organize their lunch and my lunch and get them dressed and get myself dressed and get out the door to work on time, they're like, mummy, you need to like breathe it in and blow it out to the clouds. And
That's just brilliant.
It's kind of interesting, because when kids get wound up, I'm like, what do I do to try and, you know, because they're so, you know, toddlers have a meltdown, and what I need to find a little method to for them to feel like they can do something. And then breathing just seemed to me to be something that would be useful for them to start
Absolutely.
Learning now.
Yeah, actually, you know, there was a, I was lecturing, I was as part of this day, it's a little conference at the Royal College of Emergency Medicine last year. And I was doing my little segment on nutrition and how to make quick, rapid meals for emergency staff after they finish shift instead of going to the chicken shop, which a lot of them do, not naming any names. One of the consultants, who's an emergency physician in Ireland, he is a really big fan of mindful moments during the day. Yes. So emergency medicine, the department's super stressful. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're just going from one patient to the other. And he encourages people, if they even have like 5 or 10 seconds,
yeah,
to have a mindful moment. So, for example, when you're filling out the information on a blood bottle, for example, mm-hmm, or you're writing a request for an x-ray, you know, that's 15, 10 seconds where you're not really doing, yeah, much apart from copying some information.
Yeah.
Have a mindful moment, checking with your breath.
Yeah.
Or when you're going from patient to patient and you're washing your hands. When you're washing your hands, have a mindful moment. Breathe in through your nose, breathe, yeah, out through your mouth. When you stop to have a glass of water, which you should do, and we don't do,
yeah,
enough, but have that 5-10 seconds, breathe in through your nose, breathe out through your mouth.
Yeah.
And honestly, the way his whole like demeanor, and you know, he's,
yeah,
a hard sort of hardcore emergency physician with a lot on his plate, and, mm-hmm, for him to encourage mindful moments, I thought was really encouraging.
Yeah, that's really super. I love, mm-hmm, that. I think it is about hacking your environment.
Yeah.
I know that I make sure I have a kettle in my office and I put it at the other side of where my desk is, so I have to get up and walk to the window to boil the kettle, and while I'm waiting on the kettle to boil, I'm like, just look out the window, because, mm, we're near the lots of countryside, so it's quite nice. And you know, while the kettle's boiling, I'm just looking, I'm not doing anything,
yeah,
and I'm looking far instead of my computer, which is near,
yeah,
and that switch is quite restful for the eyes and stuff, and,
yeah,
just that, like, it gets me out of my seat. I could put it next to my desk if I wanted,
yeah,
I never,
yeah,
have to move, but yeah, it's kind of hacking your environment,
yeah, sort of definitely
making that, because I think stress is pervasive, it's like almost part of our everyday language.
Mm. There was a lot of research actually looking at urban environments and how that is stress,
yeah,
provoking,
yeah,
and it affects your cognition as well. There's a great book, there's a great book that I've linked on my website, called Your Brain on Nature.
Cool.
If you haven't read it, I highly recommend,
yeah,
it. It's written by, I believe, a psychiatrist and a physician, and they basically looked at loads of studies, a lot of them coming from Japan,
mm-hmm,
looking at, you know, urban forest bathing. Mm-hmm. Sorry, not urban. For just forest bathing, the Shirinjuku, I think it's called,
yes, yeah,
and how the different sorts of phytochemicals that you find in the air,
yeah,
can actually be stress relieving,
yeah,
anti-inflammatory, as well as just the whole process of walking in nature,
yeah,
and looking at natural scenarios,
yeah,
and how that can affect your mood as well,
yeah,
for the rest of the day.
That's so,
you know, there
nice.
Is a lot of fact in there.
Yes.
There's a lot of science behind
and
it.
The other thing I read last week is, I think in Scotland,
mm,
they've just started GPs prescribing nature.
Really?
I just saw a headline. I need,
oh,
to look,
amazing,
at the details,
yeah, yeah,
maybe look it up. But yeah, there's something based on a study they did where they were encouraging people to go out to nature.
Amazing.
To try and, yeah, help as part of the treatment.
Definitely.
Which is really nice. The other thing about nature that I like, and I think is often quite forgotten, is, you know, a lot of these organisms in our environment, so we're breathing them in all the time,
mm,
these bugs that then go into our digestive tract, become part of our microbiome,
mm,
and they're abundant in nature,
mm,
you know, so you're breathing in all that, all those good bugs, soil-based bugs,
mm,
which they don't necessarily take up residence in your gut, but they pass through and they have a transient effect, and they keep that diversity going, and they bring different, you know, things to your microbiome. And so just going out in the countryside, that's really good to keep that diversity.
That's amazing.
Like,
yeah,
breathing it in.
That's,
yeah,
super interesting. And I like that aspect of the transient effect as well,
yeah,
because a lot of studies, particularly those looking at probiotics and stuff,
yeah,
even though the the gut microbes that you're, so the live microbes that you're ingesting, even though they might not take up residence in your gut, they might still be having a demonstrable effect on health outcomes. And I think that's quite important to recognize as well. So I've seen some studies where they just look whether the microbiota has changed significantly. Whereas actually there might be something else going on
and then they kind of move on their way, but it's still important. So getting into nature and stress. You know, we've talked to the different things that can trigger inflammation. Stress on its own can actually trigger these inflammatory cells in your body because they're working on the stress axis and they're releasing like noradrenaline. So these chemicals from the brain that are, they have, the immune cells have receptors on their surface, and it's saying, wow, there's some danger. Because the stress response is like a fight or flight response, isn't it? It's like you're standing in the middle of the road and there's a bus coming and you get this huge rush of adrenaline because you have to run to get out of the way. And then your body's like, well, there's an attack. I've got to prepare the immune system because, you know, get the army ready because something's happening. So all your inflammatory cells get primed. And then, you know, that adrenaline drops and then your cortisol starts to come up. And that sort of switch takes you into the next part of the inflammatory response and starts to shape it. And actually, cortisol is supposed to turn the inflammation off. So that's the kind of classic stress hormone people think about. But if you have a chronic stress situation, you just wear out all those circuits and you become less sensitive to the cortisol and the initial stressful events not going away. So you're still producing that initial burst of like chemicals that are switching on the inflammation, and it's not switching off again because the circuit's getting worn out. And the interesting thing is that to prepare your body for fight or flight, you also become quite insulin resistant because you need the glucose to fuel you to run off. And also mounting an inflammatory response is quite costly. You know, you need some sort of currency there, and glucose is like the, a great fuel to, you know, stoke that fire, and then you can run off.
You can almost like see these like downstream effects just occurring when you see that in the acute setting, which is what it's meant to do. Everything goes back down to normal. But if it's just consistently there, you have a consistent picture of that raised cortisol, the raised glucose, the insulin sensitivity, because the more exposed you are to it, the more your cells are exposed to it, the more tolerant they become. It's essentially like a drug. Like, you know, you the more you have of, I can't think of an example now, but an opiate medication, the more tolerant. And therefore,
you need more,
you need to have more of said drug or medication to have the same desired effect. It's the same thing, the same kind of concept when it comes to things like glucose.
And the thing that I find cortisol quite fascinating, don't pretend to know all of the, you know, ins and outs of it, but what it does is actually trying to switch off the inflammatory response, but in the long term it, you know, it kind of gets worn out and can't do that. But what it does do is it sort of swings the immune system towards another kind of flavor, what we call the TH2 phenotype, which I'm sure you're familiar with, is a key driver of allergy. So when you're stressed, you might end up having an allergic flare, or your allergies might be worse. You might experience eczema, or asthma attacks just by that whole like stress response being triggered.
And so you see this like in patients as well. Like whenever I ask them if someone's experiencing a flare of the psoriasis or eczema or even asthma as well, what is going on at this point in time in your life? You know, as a as an adjunct to the rest of the history, it's almost always invariably associated with stress. And people will tell you as well, like, you know, when I'm stressed, I get a psoriasis flare and I need some of those anti-inflammatory creams or anti-inflammatory medications. And, you know, there's a clear link there.
But somehow we don't quite make the link of let's deal with the stress. I mean, I'm as guilty of this as anyone, because I think I have everything in my life. I'm kind of a natural stress head sometimes. When I think of myself compared to my husband and how we kind of deal with the ebbs and flows of life, you know, he kind of it doesn't faze him so much, whereas I feel like I feel it more. But you know, even knowing what I know, that's probably the one thing that I struggle to handle the most.
Absolutely. And you can think about it from the perspective of gut health, right? So a lot of people unfortunately will automatically opt for tests to see if they're intolerant for something because they have gut symptoms every time they eat. But when you really look at the complete picture of this patient in front of you, a lot of times it is related to stress, which is having an impact on their gut symptoms, which is potentially the cause of probably other issues going on as well, but invariably the cause of some gut-related symptoms. The issue is people maybe culturally are just not accepting of the fact that stress could be causing these things, and they can't see what's right in front of them.
It's not thought of as a biological thing. It's sort of thought as a like psychological thing, isn't it?
And actually, as a GP, I have to be very careful about bringing up the concept or the subject of "Are you stressed?" Because a lot, and I think I would have the same reaction as well if someone tried to imply that something is in my head. I think is the first thing. But someone trying to imply that my physical symptom is somehow related to something that's in the locus of my control. Which, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it is. But you have to tackle that very sensitively.
And we don't. We kind of have a diffuse definition of stress as well. Isn't it? It's not really like one thing.
I find that actually. I think maybe the vernacular around stress needs to be assessed, because stress isn't just one thing. You know, there's a behavioural element to it, a psychosocial element to it, a historical element to it.
Exactly.
It's probably a genetic component as well to how we deal with different types of obstacles in our life. And to encompass that in just one word is probably a little bit you know, naive, but
I think, like the immune system, actually, what I mentioned earlier, it's only ever, the inflammatory response is only ever meant to be acute. The stress response is only really meant to be acute. It's designed that way, isn't it? And so it's when these things spill over into something a little bit more constant and intermittent that's, we really do start to see problems that filter down to our health.
As expected, we have really gone down the rabbit hole.
We can start to, I don't know, maybe we could talk about the microbiome. You mentioned the microbiome and stress. Well, I spent quite a lot of time working on leaky gut, which when we're talking about inflammation, strangely enough, the gut is actually a source of inflammation. I don't want people to be alarmed.
Strange that.
But, you know, we threw all sorts of stuff down our we're swallowing stuff in the air, all sorts of things, and we have this real delicate lining in the gut, and I've looked at many biopsies of guts over the years, and it's really hard to find a healthy gut that doesn't have some kind of inflammation there, because it's doing a lot all the time, and inflammation is trying to protect that barrier, make sure it's all okay.
Well, I suppose a healthy gut would have naturally inflammation, right? It shows that A, the immune system is working, and B, we are tolerating an environment that is essentially hostile.
Exactly, And I think everything that we know about or think about diet and disease all has the microbiome at its interface. So I always think, you know, your diet is only as good as your microbiome. If you're eating, you know, the most fantastic diet in the world, but you've had a bad history with, you know, poor gut health for whatever reason, lots of rounds of antibiotics and all sorts of things, then, you know, if that hasn't recovered properly, then you're not really going to be getting the best out of your food.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the gut is a source of inflammation. When we eat a meal, the gut naturally kind of opens up. And when you said about stress and the microbiome, actually when we're stressed, the gut opens up even more. And the reason for that is because we need that food quickly. We've got to run. We've got to do something crazy because it's fight or flight mode. So the gut is opening up even more. And unfortunately, that's good because, you know, it's helping our digestion. It's helping us absorb nutrients that we need. But at the same time, there's some collateral, that give or take. And some of the microbiome, the bugs that live in your gut, they slip through into the bloodstream. And then they become a problem because they are bacteria, after all. They're meant to live in the gut. They're not meant to live in the bloodstream. Bits of them are floating around in the body. And they contain patterns that switch on the inflammatory response because inflammation is fine-tuned to recognize when there's bacteria around, and so you get this inflammation in the blood, and you can measure it, and you can measure it in, you know, me or you, healthy people with no underlying health conditions. If you have a large meal, you will see what they call postprandial endotoxemia. Yeah. So that's when bits of bacteria are in your blood after eating, and you get a postprandial inflammatory response, and you can see inflammatory markers in the blood. And they should kind of go away again after maybe 4 hours and then back to normal. And then it starts again in the process. You know, you have your next meal, and there are certain things that make it worse. So we know
a lot of people get really freaked out by the fact that I talk about whenever I'm giving a lecture, and I talk about how digestion, by virtue of what's going on in your gut, is a pro-inflammatory process.
Yeah.
That isn't to say you shouldn't be eating.
I know,
it's just another way in which we need to re-establish what we mean by inflammation.
Yeah.
Re-establish the importance of inflammation as
well.
It's very important.
And we've started to piece together what triggers leaky gut more than others. So having a very heavy calorie dense meal kind of tends to open up your gut and make it more leaky.
Yeah.
Saturated fat, we know that this just causes the tight junctions to open.
Yeah.
So we also know that fructose, so really high doses of fructose, causes the tight junctions to open up the gut, make it leaky. So you've got more of this bacteria seeping through.
Mm.
But we also know that there's a few things that seal it up again and make it really tight. So fiber is the key one. Fiber is having a moment. I'm so happy about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whenever people ask me about immune boosting foods, I'm like, fiber.
Just fiber.
Fiber.
Yeah,
because
it's
the fuel for our microbiome.
Yeah.
And it's not the fiber per se, but it's what the microbiome does with it. They break it down. They make a whole multitude of things that we call postbiotics.
Yeah.
And the key ones are probably the short chain fatty acids.
Yeah.
So they've probably been most well researched. And one of the things that they do is they seal the gut back up again, so they make it tight.
One thing I came across recently was how you can get lots of cereals with added fiber and stuff.
Yeah.
It's quite short-sighted because the type of fiber that they're adding is usually just one type, whereas
when
you have fiber in the form of an apple, for example, you're getting multiple different types of fiber, of which there are hundreds, and those different types of fibers can actually blunt the sugar response because they form almost like a lattice inside your intestine. And so it reduces the absorption of the sugar, and it actually improves that sort of the intestinal hyperpermeability that you get, the tight junction opening.
Yeah.
So again, another reason to eat whole forms of fiber.
And it kind of reduces the caloric availability of the food, like what you mentioned with the apple. And I think, you know, if you're eating fiber poor food, it's much easier for your body to absorb all those calories, and you can overeat. And we know that overconsumption of food, as we mentioned earlier, can feed into this whole chronic inflammatory thing.
Yeah, and it's again another one of those reasons why, and we're always a bit very I'm always a bit wary when people just define their food by the calorific intake or the calorific content.
Yes.
Because an almond, a whole almond, is going to have a completely different metabolic effect compared to the same calorie content of white bread, for example, or a burger or whatever. Not to say that I'm never going to have a burger again. I'm definitely going to have a burger again. But in the majority of cases, you know, the calories or what you're absorbing from an almond is actually far less in terms of energy, but far more in terms of nutrient density.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, other things can sort of affect the gut barrier, infections, alcohol, you know, exercise can cause a bit of a leaky gut. It's all a kind of adaptation that's supposed to be a good thing.
Mm.
But yeah, the one thing to drill home is just like the fiber in the diet.
There's a paper that I'll probably put in the show notes. It was a review article in the Journal of Obesity looking at anti-inflammatory nutrition as a pharmacological intervention for obesity. And they use the word obesity, obviously, the scientists. But I just think that's absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
Where we just don't talk about, you know, the calories in, calories out stuff, even though I think that's important at the extremes.
Mm-hmm.
But anti-inflammatory nutrition as being a therapy, that's super fascinating.
Do you know what? I love that. And I'm all about the sort of anti-inflammatory lifestyle and diet as a way to sort of tweak, you know, what's going on in the body and keep you on the right side of the right balance. But I saw some, you know, on social media, you get all sides of the argument and everyone's shouting their piece. Somebody was actually like trying to poo-poo the, you know, this anti-inflammatory Mediterranean diet by saying, you know, we've got drugs for that. You can take an ibuprofen or something. And it made me think, well, yes, you can. And those are drugs that are anti-inflammatory, but they're suitable for short-term use.
Yeah.
They're not tackling the problem of chronic inflammation. They have side effects that are problematic when you take them for long periods of time. So we do need to look for more gentle lifestyle approaches to tone down inflammation. We can't just be, you know, we can't just say, oh, anti-inflammatory diet is another fad. You know, we have to, like, say, look at the utility in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of long-term benefit from people changing their lifestyle and diet.
Yes.
And although we have to sort of sift through the noise and chatter of what a lot of sensationalist claims, what's underlying the Mediterranean diet in terms of anti-inflammatory capability is super interesting. We should appreciate that.
Exactly. And people with chronic inflammatory diseases often want to look to take things out of their diet.
Mm.
And I often think of this as being like a food prison. Yeah. You know, when you look online and you're following some really strict protocol where you have to like admit, you know, 50 different foods because they might, you know, they might be causing your horrible autoimmune condition. And I think actually a lot of those foods might be quite useful, but maybe it's the amounts you're eating, and maybe it's not about what you're taking out, but what about you're putting in. So making sure you've got the fiber, because it's going to nurture the microbiome to produce these short chain fatty acids, take care of your gut lining. Short-chain fatty acids are also anti-inflammatory, so they're also being absorbed into the bloodstream, going around the body and toning down the inflammatory response. And they are really important for these T regulatory cells, these kind of peacekeepers that have been repeatedly found to be depleted in lots of chronic inflammatory conditions. So we know there's a defect in the regulatory cells. So we know fiber is a way to boost them. Not only fiber, but we need vitamin D, which is something that we're in the UK, we're quite susceptible to being deficient in. Something I found out recently was, you know, there's lots of trials around vitamin D, and often they give kind of conflicting results. The enzymes that we need in the gut to utilize vitamin D so that it can have this regulatory effect in the immune system, they're induced by certain microbiota.
Right.
So if you don't have them in your gut, you could be taking all this vitamin D supplements and, you know, sitting in the sun and all the rest of it. But maybe it's your immune system can't use it because you haven't got the right microbiota.
It's
really interesting.
I think it's so fascinating, particularly when it comes to pharmaceuticals. You know, some of them we can't use because we don't have the capacity to digest them properly. And lots of different vitamins as well. Like, you know, you can take vitamin B12, you can take iron, but if you don't have the mechanisms to digest them, actually properly utilize them, then they're just going through your system, unfortunately.
Exactly. So your diet's only as good as the bugs that eat it for you.
But there, fortunately, there are loads of things you can do to nurture that sort of population.
Exactly. And you know, if you do have, if you've given yourself this food prison where you've followed some really extreme restrictive diet online because you think it's going to cure your inflammatory disease, you're going to reduce your microbial diversity and you're going to put yourself at risk of more long-term complications.
I actually had a patient come in the other day, and he was on and he put himself on an AIP diet, an anti-inflammatory diet. Autoimmune protocol diet, which is where you remove certain things but you increase your consumption of fruits and vegetables and stuff like that. And whilst his symptoms actually had improved massively, his measures of inflammation were still quite high. In fact, it's raised. I couldn't understand that. I was just trying to figure out, like, what is going on in the pathophysiology of his body that is showing, at least in the serum levels and in the markers, that his inflammation is higher than before, but his symptoms have improved. I couldn't really understand that mismatch.
Slightly placebo?
Yeah.
If he's self-reporting
symptoms? Yeah.
Also, perhaps if he's reducing fiber, he's got this postprandial inflammation. It can even depend when you measure inflammatory markers. If he's just eaten, if he's had quite a high fat meal, if he's reduced a lot of particular food groups that are intrinsically high in fiber.
There's so much nuance to this, actually.
Yes,
and I think a lot of people are perplexed by what we can do to measure inflammation.
Yes.
I mean, in the NHS, we're pretty, you know, we have a very limited sort of test that we can actually utilize.
I think there's no good way to measure. I think we're still trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
And it could change depending on the time of day that you measure yeah. from someone. I think
in the lab you guys have a whole plethora of different things.
Yeah,
that
we normally try and measure endotoxin with this LAL assay, but even that, it's, you know, endotoxins everywhere. It's a bacterial component that we know triggers inflammation, and it leaks from the gut into the bloodstream. Mm. We also do things like CRP and IL-6 and TNF.
Yeah.
But we're starting to look at the different LPS binding proteins.
Okay.
So
yeah.
things that form the toll-like receptor 4.
Yeah, yeah. LPS binding protein will be useful. I think there are some companies that do that in the private world. I'm not too sure
Maybe.
How accurate everything is, though.
Yeah.
But IL-6, I think, would be super fascinating.
Yeah.
I know in the States, they look at things like HSCRP, so high-sensitivity CRP, and homocysteine, which I think is quite important for a lot of people.
Also, hemoglobin A1C.
Yeah.
So this is a measure of, like, your blood sugar over quite a period of time, like several months. And, you know, if you have sugar hanging around in the blood, it kind of sticks to things. So that's why we have these mechanisms in our body where we produce insulin and we get it out of the blood as quick as possible and store it as glycogen in our liver or in our muscles. And when we constantly have sugar going into the system, it's constantly in the blood and we're having to work hard to get it out of the blood because it sticks to things and it glycates them. And when we get these sort of glycation end products, they're called, the immune cells actually have receptors for these as well. So again, this can be a dangerous signal, switching on inflammation. There's lots of sugar hanging around. And that's not to say sugar is bad, but it's normalizing your blood sugar, and like you don't need to constantly be eating sugar from the moment you wake till
you
go to bed.
This whole concept of this ages production, the advanced glycemic end products, as a result of a high sugar diet, and those causing inflammation by essentially being like big clumpy materials that like bump into things and then essentially like cause trauma. And, and there's a whole bunch of other mechanisms behind it as well, but that's the way I like to analogy of but yeah, I suppose that's one of the reasons why we see like high sugar diets and inflammation.
Yes.
Not to say that like all sugar is the devil, essentially.
Yeah.
I think there's a bit of miscommunication there as well. And I often get asked about the link between sugar and inflammation and the evidence behind that. And whilst there is, and whilst I would always advise, you know, a relatively low sugar diet, a low added refined sugar diet, it isn't to say that, you know, you can't have things like bread or whole grain pasta or, you know,
and,
whole grains.
A lot of the foods that contain sugar are intrinsically also the foods that have fiber inside. So like you say, like grains and root vegetables and stuff like starchy vegetables, the fiber is really important. They come with, you know, sugar packaged up in different forms at the same time. It's not to say sugar is bad for you. You know, and the immune system runs on sugar. I always think of, you know, the macros matter. People ask me about micronutrients all the time. What vitamins go to boost my immune system? But I'm like, you know, the macros matter, the fats, the carbs, the proteins. The proteins are important for the immune system to build the armies, to do various things. But also the, you know, glucose from whichever source you get it from, whether it's the most starchy vegetable or whole grain, or whether it's from a bag of sweets, it all gets broken down to sugar in our body.
Definitely.
In different ways. And this is the currency that the immune system uses to mount inflammatory responses, because they are costly. They need an energy resource. So what happens when we're mounting inflammation? It's quite interesting, actually. I think you've already spoken maybe about cancer
with
Dr. Ilse. I'm sure she described quite nicely the Warburg effect. So this is a phenomenon that we see in cancer cells where they have this increased uptake of glucose for fuel. And a couple of years ago, really quite recently, they've discovered that the immune system does exactly the same, this Warburg effect, when they're mounting an inflammatory response. So the way that they, you know, rapidly use glucose, and it all sounds very scary. So it's not to say that having lots of sugar causes this to happen, but if you're already on that inflammatory train because you're stressed and you've, you know, got all other things going on in your lifestyle, sugar is the fuel that's going to drive that train forward.
Yeah.
And I think we're really starting to unpick this immunometabolism, so at the level of the immune cells, but also at the level of us as a whole person. And the interesting thing is that these peacekeeper cells that I keep mentioning, these Tregs, they don't use sugar for their metabolism. So they oxidize lipids.
Right.
So they have a totally different metabolism from the inflammatory cells. Which I think is interesting in itself, that they choose different fuels to do their job.
That is really interesting. For, again, from an evolutionary perspective, I'm trying to figure out what would be the advantages of having two different types of cells with two different fuel sources. And that's why I suppose you see an anti-inflammatory effect when you have like more things like omega-3 and fatty acids in your diet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I think, you know, if you have a poor diet that's really high in sugar, and you might have a bit of metabolic dysfunction, metabolic disease, type 2 diabetes, a chronic low-grade inflammation because of your lifestyle, and you're lacking the fiber, the, you know, you're not going to be able to nurture that regulatory component, and you're not going to be able to make the switch. It's kind of like something's broken where you can't switch between the fat-oxidizing regulators and then the sugar fueling the inflammatory response. And I think that's where we're still not clear on what's going on with the switch, but there's definitely a way that the immune system is sensing our nutritional status. And that's what I mean when people are over consuming calories. There's a sign that like the, there's an abundance of nutrition, and I think when we reduce that, and there's a lot of work around fasting, and that's showing miraculous changes in inflammatory diseases, because it's just tapping the brakes on that, and it's restricting the glucose, and you have to oxidize your own body fat stores because that's what's available to you for energy, and it's a different kind of fuel, and that's going to nurture the regulatory cells.
So. This is a nice segue into our rapid fire round of questions, actually, because we've been chatting for ages. Intermittent fasting and inflammation. This is a super interesting topic because from what I've seen of fasting, and just as a caveat, you know, fasting is only appropriate for those who have a comfortable relationship with food, who you know, are doing it conscientiously. But the evidence base looking at what happens when you fast to inflammation, to upregulating autophagy, removing these senescent cells that are just hanging around causing inflammation, and the microbiome effect, I think it's really, really interesting.
It's profound, isn't it? And I really hope that we get some concrete picture coming out of the literature soon, because already people are talking about their own different protocols that you should do, and people are dipping their toe in it. And I kind of think, why does it have to be all or nothing? So we know that a lot of people self-report fasting or even like a low-carb diet really helps with their symptoms if they have some inflammatory disease. And it's probably just because they're, well, there's many mechanisms going on, but, you know, they're withholding fuel, so the inflammatory thing can't keep running anymore. So like I say, fasting functions on many levels. It does a lot of things, but it's, you know, reducing the energy intake. We know that energy surplus can stoke the inflammatory fire. And it's also mildly stressful. Like you say, it kills off the old cells.
This kind of concept of like the hormetic effect I find fascinating as well, right? Where a little bit of bad does you some good, because it encourages your body to essentially have a resilient effect. You know, it's kind of encouraging the mechanisms that lead to survival.
Exactly. Encouraging you to be able to utilize your fat stores and not just, you know, keep stoking the inflammatory fire. And that, I think it's... you know, have you ever heard of that kind of old phrase, feed a cold starve a fever?
I've heard of that,
You know, it's like an old wives' tale, but there's actually some truth in it, because when you have a fever, so the saying goes, starve a fever. You know, that's a huge inflammation on the body, because you've got high fever and temperature, you're very, very sick. And they did a lot of work into this like several years ago to see if it was actually true. So what this huge immunologist in the US, Russian guy, and it's actually a way of stopping so much damage in the body.
Right.
Because by having a fever, you don't want to eat. You're taking away the fuel source, and it's the inflammation's still going because it's trying to reduce the infection, but it can't go overboard and actually physically damage your body.
Yeah.
So that's why they do think there's some truth in that.
That's
so
super interesting.
Perhaps in the term, in the frame of chronic inflammation, perhaps there could be something in it too, like with withholding food.
Yeah.
It kind of pulls the immune system back. But we just don't have a sound protocol that we know works yet.
Exactly,
and
yeah.
I think experimenting at home can be quite dangerous.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, inflammation is protecting us. So if you withdraw too much, then you get a lot of problems. And if you have a long-term low-carbohydrate diet, you can see that, and it can start eating the mucus in your gut, you know, your own bugs, because there's no fuel source. They need the carbohydrates. So I think it doesn't need to be all or nothing, but it'd be really good to have some clinical protocols for different disease
states. I totally see that. And, you know, even people in the research looking at fasting protocols are still waiting on the long-term research to figure out what sort of different protocols are relevant for different people.
Yeah.
What a protocol looks like, is that, you know, a water fast for 2 or 3 days, or is it just a shorter term fast, like 16-8 or whatever? I always recommend people just have a rough eating window of anywhere between 10 and 12 hours. So in reality, that is having your breakfast at 8 in the morning and then finishing your dinner by like 7 or 8 p.m.
Yeah, you know? I think this is like, it's a sensible framework. It's something that you could sort of implement into your life. And going back to the leaky gut thing, it's reducing the time that you're eating.
Exactly.
So you're having less time where you have this postprandial endotoxemia.
Postprandial endotoxemia.
Sorry.
It gets me every time. Yeah.
The leaky gut.
Yeah, I know. I think it's very important for people to be a lot more medically sound in terms of their understanding of these terms, because leaky gut, you know, if you type in leaky gut into Google, you just get everything.
Yes.
You type in leaky gut into PubMed, you probably won't get much.
No, exactly.
So using that kind of terminology is great. Cool. Okay. Let's do the rapid question round.
Right, let's do it.
Right. These are, I mean, we've actually covered quite a few of these already.
Oh,
sugar and inflammation
good.
Is the first one.
Yeah.
I think we've definitely talked about that, about how, you know, it can stoke the inflammatory fire. Sugar is very important as a fuel for mechanisms. So it's not about removing all sugar. It's about making sure that you're choosing quality sugars in your diet and limiting the ones from refined sources. Anti-inflammatory diets, are they worth it?
Well, the studies, I think, that have shown they work in people with chronic diseases. So you only get a kind of shift in the disease when it's already somebody who's quite sick, from what we know from the clinical studies. I think that it's sensible for most of us to have an anti-inflammatory diet, using something like the Med diet as a guideline, because it's not really excluding things.
Exactly.
It's bringing in the fiber. We've talked about how important that is. Omega-3s, which is part of the switch to resolving inflammation. You need to start pulling omega-3s instead of omega-6 to have this pro-resolution response, which is rich in the Med diet. And it has all the colourful phytonutrients from, you know, fresh produce and all that. So, yeah, I'd say it's worth it. I think if you have a chronic disease, then definitely it's could be an adjunct that would maybe make your day more bearable, make your disease symptoms more manageable.
Do you see a future for anti-inflammatory diets and inflammatory disorders like rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, psoriatic, psoriasis?
Yes, and I think the data is coming through. There's some conflicts and some things that don't add up. But again, I think a lot of that pertains to when you do human intervention studies, you know, we're biologically very different, but also our microbiomes are really different. They even recently, I think it was Tim Spector's group did a nice study on omega-3s and showing that if you didn't have certain gut bacteria, the omega-3, you couldn't utilize it in a certain way.
Yeah.
So when you see these huge trials with saying, oh, omega-3s don't actually do anything in the body, you know, it you have to put it in the context of how the research was done, and remember that, you know, the microbiome is like our fingerprint. We're all so unique, and that's the interface between diet and disease and health. So.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think there's so much nuance to our intervariability. Like, I know my genomics is going to be distinct from a lot of other people's, yours for example, and my microbiota is going to be different as well. So how I respond to a dietary intervention, a pharmaceutical, a supplement like omega-3 is going to be vastly different. And unfortunately, we just don't have the power to do this.
It would be amazing if we could. And I know they've done those studies with people wearing continuous glucose monitors.
Yes.
And they show like really cool data, like two different people both eating a bowl of rice, and one, you know, the insulin's going through the roof, and the other person that's like, you know,
absolutely
flatlined. So we, how we respond on a metabolic level to different foods varies. So when people are shouting about how low carb is amazing, or, you know, high carb is amazing, it might not work for another person, because, you know, where your starting point is, what your microbiome's like, what your metabolism's like, it's going to be so different.
I've actually used some of those CGMs, continuous glucose monitors,
have
for some patients. Yeah, that
I thought you were
going to
say for yourself.
No, but I probably
self-experimenting.
I probably will, actually, because they're, I mean, they're relatively cheap.
Yeah.
They actually ran out, the producers of it ran out, because I think so many people were self-experimenting. But I've actually done it with some patients who are pre-diabetic, or I suspect are pre-diabetic from some of their blood results. And honestly, what I would consider something that's like relatively good for someone might not actually be, or wasn't actually relevant, for, wasn't suitable for them. So oats, for example. A lot of people find oats. I love oats. You know, I recommend it and stuff.
I mean, but I'm Scottish. So I'm all about the oats. Grew up on oats.
But for this particular person, it wasn't suitable at all.
Wow.
And you could just see this spike as soon as they had it. And like, you know, 1-2 hours afterwards, you just like see this maintained glucose response.
Wow.
And when we mixed it around a bit, and we actually still had some oats, actually.
Yeah.
But then we added different nuts and seeds to it.
Right.
Changed the milk around. We took the banana, you know, took away the banana, actually added some other low sugar fruits. Massive difference.
That's fascinating. I think that's really, that to me, that just screams like the meal is the sum of its parts.
Yes.
You know, we don't want to look at nutrients in isolation anymore, because it's not, actually not very useful. And like dietary patterns are much more helpful. Like,
totally.
Like what you're saying about sort of a time window of eating, like patterns of eating. And that's,
And there's so many different things that will predict what that person's glucose response is going to be, right? Like whether they were stressed at the time of eating, or whether they'd actually had a full night's sleep the night before, or what they actually ate the night before, because that's going to have affected, you know, what's in their gut and everything. So and you know what, we've covered a lot of the other questions about weight loss, inflammation, intermittent fasting, vampire blood. Have you heard about this? Young blood being transfused and how that's having an anti-aging effect. I mean, the ethics aside,
I'd have to look into the mechanisms,
I think there was something that came out in Cell. I'll have to forward it to you about the potential mechanisms of this, but people are already seeing the monetary value and they're spinning out companies where they're charging exorbitant amounts for young blood to be transfused and stuff. And I don't think they have the data to prove that it works, but certainly in mice they do. So when you transfuse an old aging mice, mouse, with young blood from a young healthy mice, that the health effects are actually.
And how long does it last?
That's another good question, because I think in mice it will be very different.
Yeah.
I think they were looking at the endpoint of lifespan,
right?
And it significantly improved their lifespan.
It's really hard to do that in humans, isn't
really
it?
Hard to do that, yeah.
But I was
damn
thinking,
us for living so long.
You know, I'd rather have a microbiome from somebody who's young and
that's
fit,
super interesting,
because there's actually a lot of studies doing swaps with old and young microbiomes.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned earlier, like the microbiome changes as we age.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that could be upstream of the blood, because lots of metabolites from the microbiome is going into the blood.
Yeah.
And that's like our own personalized pharmacy
Yeah.
of stuff. And maybe that's something that's in the young blood.
Maybe you can get two for one.
Exactly. Yeah, I know. We should set our own clinic doing
blood and poop transfusions
from young victims. Anyone wants to volunteer?
There you have it, another podcast with the wonderful Dr. Jenna. You can catch her on socials at Dr. J Mac Twitter and Dr._Jenna_Machocchi. All these are going to be on the show notes on Instagram as well. And check out her website, which has got some fantastic articles looking at everything from the perspective of immune health. It's drjennamachocchi.com. Again, that's going to be on the show notes. If I was to summarize our conversation in a dietary way of life, it would be the Mediterranean diet. As we alluded to in our conversation, it is known to be anti-inflammatory. And now you have an understanding of what we mean by anti-inflammation. Inflammation isn't something that we need to radically remove. It is something that should be welcomed, but in the context of our modern lifestyles, we are usually out of balance. If you have a copy of my book, make sure you check out the page where I actually have a diagram looking at what is pro and what is anti-inflammatory in our modern world. Vegetables are key. Citrus have flavonoids, grapes have anthocyanins, apples have procyanidins. There are all lots of different types of chemicals that are anti-inflammatory. They work in a multitude of different pathways, including NF-kappa B and a whole bunch of other confusing long chemical names that you don't need to know about. The easiest way to have an anti-inflammatory diet is getting a variety of different colored fruits and vegetables, having quality fats, things from nuts, seeds, and fish oils. If you do eat fish, is absolutely key to getting that nice balance of fats that have anti-inflammatory properties. Fiber, as I've always talked about before, fiber is super important from the perspective of inflammation, as well as lots of different perspectives when we're looking at different medical specialties. So having fiber from legumes, nuts again, different sorts of bran and whole grains is a great way of improving your microbiota that have natural anti-inflammatory ability. Looking at your stress levels. Now, we talked about this with Dr. Rangan on a previous podcast. Make sure you check that out again on the podcast page on the website. But looking at resetting your stress levels, particularly in the morning, I think is a very interesting thing to do from the perspective of inflammation. Whether it's using an alarm clock instead of your phone, whether it's a mantra in the morning, whether it's just simple deep breathing that you do for 3 minutes before you start your day, I do recommend a stress relieving, therefore anti-inflammatory activity in the morning to help start your day on the right note. Exposing yourself to nature, walking through pine trees. There's lots of different Japanese research looking at forest bathing, getting yourself, if it is at the weekends or even if you're walking through parks during the week, it's a fantastic way of, again, resetting your stress levels, but also exposing yourself to those natural anti-inflammatory chemicals that you find in Greenland. You can find all this information in my new book, The Doctor's Kitchen: Eat to Beat Illness, is out to pre-order now on Amazon, and check out the show notes where I've summarized our conversation and you have all the show notes there as well. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, give it a 5-star review and share it with your friends. It really does help get the message out there, and see you next time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.